BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan MacLeod. Now, I'm in Johannesburg today to chat to Justin McCarthy and Steve Sidley about Project Ubu, which is launching a cryptocurrency to deliver a universal basic income. Now, Project Ubu, and I'm quoting from their media release here, was established as a mechanism to enable the free market redistribution of inefficient resources, with the objective being to promote growth-enabling economic access to billions of excluded people. The idea is to create a cryptocurrency that, quote, unlocks dormant, inefficiently allocated, and unrealized resources to create commercial and social value. Justin, Steve, thanks for joining me on the Tech Central podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
How did the idea for Project Ubu come about? And please explain in layman's language what it is you are hoping to achieve.
There's about five questions in that part, so I'll tell you I'll tell you a little bit about the history.
Sure.
The originator of the idea is a gentleman by the name of Dudley Bayliss, and he was he's very involved in a number of projects that involve distribution of resources into underprivileged areas. And he was having lunch with some people, and a lady asked him, why is it, the question was the genesis of this, a lady asked him, why is it that people, poor people, who don't have any material wealth, are not regarded as being, are not regarded as having value?
Hmm.
And the straightforward economic answer to that is, well, they're not producing wealth, so therefore. But if you go beyond the economic theory and into sort of the humanitarian space, everybody does have value to contribute. And the barrier that exists between those who contribute and those who don't contribute basically is access to the economy and being able to become economically productive. And if you're born into the circumstances of poverty, for instance, that's one example, you just never really get to escape it. You know, one in a million gets to escape that trap. And you could be, you know, you could be the next Albert Einstein in South Sudan, for argument's sake. But without the resources, you're just never going to get past go. So that's the history behind, or the story behind the origin of it. So from there, Dudley started thinking about the ideas and started speaking to a number of his old friends and associates, and I was one of them. And when I came to chat to him one day, about a year or so ago, he floated this idea past me, and I left scratching my head going, this madman is off the rails again. I've known Dudley for 30 odd years, so I can say that. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about, to be honest. But then we got together again a couple of weeks later, and this thing grew, and now we're operating, and we're reasonably close to a public launch, which we'll get down to later.
Okay, well, tell me a bit about it and what it is exactly.
Okay, well, look, the product itself is an electronic wallet, an e-wallet, which will carry a token of exchange, which without getting too technical, let's just call it a cryptocurrency for now, because it has many of the attributes of a cryptocurrency. It's a digital it's a digital unit of account. Mm-hmm. The UBI component is, and UBI in itself is a whole subject, universal basic income. There are about 15 or so examples have been tried around the world by governments and NGOs. Some people call it a universal basic income, others call it so what's the other term, Steve, can you remember?
UBI?
Unconditional yeah. basic income.
Yes.
Universal indicates that it's for everybody, mm-hmm. Although most experiments has not been, so it's been for like segments of society. Namibia probably ran the most complete study ever for 2 years, and they ended it a couple of years back. In fact, it was heavily informed by a professor of economics here from the University of Pretoria, and it was an incredibly successful project. And what most of the big studies in UBI have indicated is that, contrary to the sort of common belief that if you, you know, the old adage, give a man a fish and give a man a fish, he'll have a meal. Mm-hmm. Teach him to fish, and he'll be able to sustain himself for life. It's actually not as accurate as that in the real world. A lot of people think, and based somewhat on social welfare in places like the UK, for instance, you go on the dole, well, you're disincentivized to work, etc. That is not the case with underprivileged. As soon as they have the ability to, and one of the great analogies is like energy. We all have, or our bodies need an X amount of energy per day to function, which means we have to fuel it with food and water, obviously. So if you, using that analogy, if you are part of the poor, and you live in poverty, you expend most of your energy just existing, living from one day to the next. And a good South African example of that is the guys who go around the suburbs of Johannesburg. I've seen them in Cape Town and other cities as well. They pick up, they recycle the refuse, the paper and the plastics and whatnot, and they take them down to Alexandra in their trolleys, and they exchange it on a kilogram basis, weight basis, for rands. And pretty much they live, I mean, I've spoken to a few of them just as a matter of interest as to how their system operates. And pretty much they live a hand-to-mouth existence. And that's, and they, but they expend all that energy, and they work hard. They start at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's quite intense labor. And their reward for that is two meals a day, pretty much. That's and they only get to do that once a week, and in between, God knows what they do. Mm. You know, it's hard to say. So, when and all the research has shown is that when you give people a enough whatever it is, whether it's money or food, just to survive, they then turn their energy and attention to becoming economically productive. Mm. That they're not happy just to survive. That there's a very innate human need to be more productive
useful.
Than that.
Useful.
And useful.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is the basic idea behind social grants in this country.
It is the basic idea. Universal basic income is largely theoretical. It's, I think it originated, depends which version you read, but up to 400 years ago, maybe even longer. It goes, it's been plucked out from Roman times 2,000 years ago. But it's never been put into practice to the extent where it's been robustly tested as this is something that could work at a national level. The idea is, in theory, the idea is it's not just an amount of money from which you have the choice to do with what you want, but in fact, it replaces all other forms of government support, such as, for instance, education, medical healthcare, etc. So it's one income that'll cover all of those expenses. That's the theory. Mm. So, it'll remain economic theory for a long time, and it's not going to, I don't think UBI is going to dynamically change economies, but what it can do is bring people who are not able to contribute economically into the economic system, and then the whole economy benefits as a result of it. Mm. That's the theory.
Okay. Now, reading through the media release that you prepared ahead of this discussion, you're going to have this e-wallet. You'll be able to download this e-wallet onto your phone for free. That'll be available later this year.
Yes.
you then will get value in this wallet, Ubus in this wallet, for free.
Correct.
Where is that value being created? Are those donations from corporate South Africa? Just explain how the value creation is going to happen here.
Okay. Fundamentally, and I'm going to give you a sort of catch-all answer, and then you can you can drill down into maybe some examples, and Steve can chip in at any time. But the broad-based approach is that we're looking to unlock what we call moribund capital or trapped capital. There are lots of pockets in every economy where there's very inefficient systems where capital is unrealized, money in some shape or form, capital. And what we want to do is essentially give the market an instrument in which they can unlock that capital and bring greater efficiency to their businesses and more growth to their businesses. And the Ubu is a mechanism by which we think we can do that. So we will issue them every single day to registered citizens or people who have to register on our database and download the app. And then from there on, once they're activated, they will get a daily issuance for the rest of their lives, basically in perpetuity as far as they're concerned, to use as they see fit. And then obviously the trick is to lock that, or to try and match that to some extent on the other side. That's the supply side, the demand side, with vendors, merchants, who will accept it as a form as a token of exchange, or token of value. Sorry.
So this capital you talk about, this inefficiently or capital that's not being used. Perhaps give me some examples of what that might include and why a company might see this as a better means of unlocking the potential of that capital.
Okay, so let me add to this. This is Steve speaking here. There are many spokes of this wheel. The question that you ask has sort of many threads. So just let me talk about the direct one that you addressed at first. Examples of unrealized capital would be things like moribund loyalty points at corporations, which they can't get off their balance sheets. It would be obsolete stock. It would be old stock. It would be expiring stock. It would be
which they then sell to you, and you'd convert into currency.
They don't sell it to us. They give it to.
They give it to us.
Okay. Yes,
to us. They give it to the consumer.
Yeah.
With Ubus in their wallet.
Yes, exactly.
So they exchange it for, instead of for rands, they exchange it for Ubus.
Okay.
There are NGOs who distribute donated material. In addition to that, there is a whole industry that is built on providing social good at little or no cost, such as clinic treatments or education or grants of those sort, which would be perfect for this. And it brings up an important point you made. The question is, well, how does this thing get value? Well, while we have given you a couple of mechanisms at which it would initially get value, the same question was asked of Bitcoin when it started. It was valueless.
Yes.
Then somebody decided that 10,000 of the things would buy a pizza. Mm. So what happens is when you spark the thing with some of the trapped asset, it begins to grow an organic value just like Bitcoin or any other currency does. So there are two arms, or there are two pieces to this puzzle. The first piece of the puzzle is to spark value with the trapped or moribund or unrealized assets. And the second one is the growth of organic value, just like in the other cryptocurrencies. Mm. And the project is rolling out to focus on both those areas in a chronological sequence.
And that automatically get a value because you're going to be giving these away to people.
Exactly.
So there's a value, and they've got this on their phones and they can use it.
Yeah, and in fact, it's in better shape than a lot of the other cryptocurrencies which are being launched on a hope and a prayer that people will see some value in this.
Yes.
This will get sparked by a value on the ground, which will be those assets that we're talking about, and a great need out in the community to get access to those assets. So when we decide to go to a public cryptocurrency, it's in there with an exchange rate.
Okay. Why a cryptocurrency specifically? It sounds like you could do this without crypto.
Yeah. So let me answer that. We are in the space in which a traditional approach to this thing suffers hazards. And the hazards that they suffer, first of all, governmental approaches, as we know with social grants, suffers the hazards, especially in some of the developing nations and partially in first worlds as well, is that they become a sieve for theft, as we've seen in this country, in India and various other countries. Secondly, and even worse, they become Harvard Business Studies on inefficiencies of distribution. And we know that from social grants in South Africa, where people have to walk long distances and very, very expensive equipment to, you know, to authenticate them against thumbprints and ATM payout machines, et cetera, et cetera. So from the get-go, a system of exchange, a token of exchange based on traditional banking systems where there are rent seekers along the way, wouldn't work for us. The second one is when you have a token whose job in life is to exchange goods between people, you are in the business of trust. And what the cryptocurrency gives you, or at least what blockchain gives you, is the ability to devolve trust from a central authority like a bank or a government into a very anonymous and very public set of eyes which guarantee the trust. It's the whole point of blockchain. So while one could roll this out in a non-blockchain set of technologies, just transaction processes, and would work, as soon as we move from what I call the first magisteria, which is the token of exchange, to the second magisteria, which is the token of value, as soon as you move into token of value, you're into the, you're in the area of money, currency, and trust, and blockchain is the most appropriate and the cheapest and most efficient way to do that.
Okay, okay. Is it, I mean, when you hear cryptocurrencies, certainly when I hear cryptocurrencies, I think complexity. Is this going to be something that's very easy to understand for the end user? They're going to install this app on the phone, they know exactly what it means and what to do with it?
Yeah, well, the complexity is a little bit illusory. Just like when you use your iPhone, you don't know what the complexity of the chip is. The actual application itself for the user is trivial to use. We were aware when we designed the application it would not be at the high end of the technologically literate spectrum. So we're going to be doing very easy authentication, and there are only three or four buttons on the entire application. You can send money, you can receive money, you can spend money, etc. The back end of the systems is no more or less complex than any other technology systems, which we all use every day, including those people who know nothing about technology, who use phones and computers. And the blockchain itself does not have to be described in terms of crypto. It only has to be described in terms of the fact that it guarantees trust in the transaction.
Okay. What about security? We hear about hacking incidents involving cryptocurrencies all the time, and exchanges as well.
In fact, only exchanges. None of the blockchains have been hacked. They are inordinately secure, and exchanges have been hacked because they're built by third parties and they're not built with the sort of blockchain security in mind. That being said, we are hypersensitive about security once we move to token of value, and it will become a major design criterion.
Okay. So how is the value of an Ubu going to be determined? Is it going to be a freely traded currency like Bitcoin or Ethereum? Are there going to be exchanges? Are they going to be, will I be able to buy and trade this currency?
I'm going to turn over to Justin here.
Okay.
Yeah, not initially, no.
Okay.
No. So in fact, it'd be a little bit more accurate to call it a token rather than a cryptocurrency, because there is no mining involved in phase one. The mining is done. Look, let me back up a little bit. So we're doing a test version before we take it into the open market, and onto a public blockchain. We're testing on a private blockchain. We're doing that for the purposes of ensuring that the system is robust, that we can meet the sort of demand that we might anticipate, which could be tens of millions of people, or hundreds of millions in time. And so we need to sense check all of that before you really break it open into a public domain. So the difference between a public and a possibly an important point for listeners who are not aware, the difference between a public and a private blockchain is a blockchain is a distributed ledger. That's really what it is. A private one is run that is run by a bunch of consensus servers controlled by an organization. Banks use them, big data companies use them, and we will be doing the same at the outset, in the initial phase. The intent then is once we've migrated it, as Steve says, from what did you call it, the magisterium of
token of exchange to token of value, private to public,
is into the public blockchain, which is now running it either on our own blockchain or running it on somebody else's blockchain, like Ethereum, for argument's sake, which is really well designed to carry multiple things, not just transactions, but smart contracts, etc., which may be a feature that we want to build into it in the future. Mm. So we haven't taken that decision as yet. We're investigating our opportunities. So to come back to the question, the market's going to set the value. Ultimately, we would like to be able to control it and say, you know, let's peg it like an e-buck at 10% of a rand. At 10, you know, one Uber equals 10 cents. The truth is that we're never, you can't do that.
How does the market set the rate, though?
It's bid and ask prices on an open exchange. That's how they do it.
Okay.
Yeah. There's no organization controlling the rate. It's pure market value.
Right.
So let me give you an example. And because it is problematic, if for instance, you've got 1,000 Ubers in your wallet, and let's just give you a simple example, and Shop A offers you a pack of washing powder at 20 Rand plus 500 Ubers. Shop B offers it at 20 Rand plus 400 Ubers. You've got pricing mechanism. Mm. Pricing is a very dynamic thing. So, you know, I think initially we will have a great deal of variety in terms of the value that vendors put onto it. And I'm just giving a retail example.
Sure.
Because they're the easiest ones to give, because everyone goes to the supermarket and buys stuff. But it goes way beyond that in terms of the different sectors that we would like to get into. In fact, every sector. And the market will fluctuate, I think, quite widely. The value that's placed on it is really up to the vendor or the merchant. But I think within a reasonably short space of time, we anticipate that band will narrow down to, you know, somewhere between, it'll fix somewhere between 10 and 12 cents or 20 and 25 cents or whatever it is. Mm. That probably within a narrow trading range of 10 to 20% variance from A to B. Mm. And it depends on what the merchant wants to do with it. And that is another entity where we've got half a dozen ideas about how we can do it, and we're approaching merchants and vendors with that. But really what we want the market to do is to see a couple of examples and go, okay, I see how that works for XYZ. How can I apply that in my business? Mm-hmm. And that's where... The market itself will come up with 1,000 more instances than we could ever dream up sitting around the table, boardroom table.
I just wanted to add to that and then to answer a question which you haven't asked yet, but I suspect you will for the economists who are listening to this broadcast. So the addition that I want to make to Justin's comments is that what we are doing here is we are building in a private capacity, in a non-public capacity, in a non-floated exchange currency capacity. We are looking to build a huge customer base, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, thousands of vendors, and value in the unit itself because it has been sparked by trapped assets. Compare that to the cryptocurrencies which are being launched daily, who have no customers, no vendors, and no value. Mm. We believe that when we go to the public exchanges as a public cryptocurrency, we will be streaks ahead of the many cryptocurrencies that are out there now. And you can see if you look at the market cap of cryptocurrencies, there's 750 out there. Mm. And there may be 10 or 20 who have a reasonable value. And the reason is that you can't sustain all those things when they come into the market with nothing but hope that people will trade. The economic question I think that you're going to pose, but let me preempt over here, is if you're going to give people free money every day, how do you control inflation? Now, in traditional money supplies, there is a limited money supplies, and the central bank decides to release or take back currency in the market in order to control inflation. In the case of Bitcoin, they mine 21 million coins, and that's all they're ever going to mine, and they will be out there in the market going up and down in value. This cryptocurrency, when it becomes a currency in phase two, is utterly unique in that you give people money every day. I don't want to say money, I want to say you give them the token of value every single day. How then do you control currency? And it has the absolutely unique and differentiated quality that you also take it away from them if they don't use it.
Oh.
So it's called the dissipation factor, and you lose money out of your wallet every day unless it is used. So what it does is it stimulates transactions. And we have a very sophisticated set of economic mathematics that sit at the core of this, which will be published in a white paper by the end of August for economics and mathematicians to pour over to make sure that we have got the monetary system robust and stable before we launch.
Fascinating. So this is really being encouraged as a transactional platform rather than a store of value. You're not going to put your nest
there's going to be no hoarders in this system, although it is true that we are going to provide a mechanism in which you can buy a bond, which would be a way to store them. But the real value of this thing lies in the fact that it's getting people to buy stuff for their kids and stimulating the economy by transacting.
So what percentage of the value of your wallet do you lose every day?
I'm not sure whether we should say this in case anybody holds our feet to the fire later, but it's in the single-digit percentages. It's low. If you did nothing, you would lose your wallet within 50 to 100 days.
Right.
We haven't locked in on the number yet.
Okay. But the idea is to encourage spending.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I think it's, I have to say, quite astute of you to pick that up, because most people don't, in that one of the fundamental issues with currencies in the modern world, once the gold standard was abandoned, is that, what's underpinning it? 95% of the world's currencies are not underpinned. Mm. And if we all rushed to our banks, with the whole world rushed to our banks tomorrow and said, "We'll give you my deposits in whatever shape or form," we'd get 5 cents on the dollar if it was evenly distributed, like through a sequestration sort of proceeding. And that's a lot of people say, well, why are you, it's anti-saving, it's anti-this, you're encouraging consumption. Yes, we are, because we need two things. We need adoption and we need velocity. And the velocity of a currency, as you know, is critical. and it's a very specifically chosen method in order to not be hoardable and then just continue the contributing to the existing system, the current system, without getting into the philosophy of it. The idea is to allow access into the economy, and the reason that poor people don't have access to the economy is because they don't have any assets. So there's we're not replacing anything, by the way. It's also a very important point to make. We're not looking to replace any currencies or any other mechanisms in the marketplace. It's in addition to.
I was going to ask, is this in effect going to be a competitor to the rand?
No, I don't think we'll ever be a competitor to the rand. No. It's very, very, very difficult to predict. I wouldn't sit here and try and predict that. But no, and we don't want to be. That's not the objective. And we need to be very clear about that that's not what we're setting out to do.
Right.
The RAND has, and every currency, every national currency has a role to play, and they must continue to play those roles, and the government can play that. And, as you probably know, our own Reserve Bank is reasonably well down the line in looking at blockchain and cryptocurrencies for application in the South African market. But the reason for that, I would suspect, like China and Russia is as well, is because if they don't, their currencies are going to be left behind by the technology. So they have to adapt. the purpose of this entire project, and we call it a project, but it's a lifelong project, is for the value that's created there, is to unlock the locked value and allow that to trickle down so that the beneficiaries, everyone will benefit, but the real beneficiaries are people who have nothing, who have no asset base whatsoever, and can start to build up an asset base. So if its value of the unit starts out for the first year is 10 cents, and in 10 years' time it's 10 rand, well, and if you're getting 100 of those a day, it's a meaningful.
Have you had any conversations with the Reserve Bank about what you're doing here? Or have they shown any interest in Project Uber at this stage?
We've had conversations with people who know people, if you excuse the cliché. What we are not trying to do is we're not a bunch of sort of economic religious zealots who are trying to create a parallel currency system like some of the other cryptocurrencies in order to sidestep the world's financial system. We're not in that game. Others are, and others are in that game successfully, but we're not trying to avoid taxes and be anonymous and all of that sort of stuff. It's not a currency that plays that role. From what we know of the people who know people at the Reserve Bank, as Justin mentioned, is the blockchain and cryptocurrencies a matter of great interest to them. I know people at the Reserve Bank from my previous lives in payments. These are very smart people. When we take the phase B step into public cryptocurrency, we will convene with them and tell them what we're doing and ask for their advice and make sure we're doing, we're paying taxes and all the other things.
Right, okay. So this is not meant to be an anonymous platform.
It's not meant to be anonymous in the same way that Bitcoin is an anonymous wallet. We will be holding information about each person who downloads the wallet. That information will be secure, but not anonymous. They're okay. Different.
Is there a FICA type of process that happens? Or?
There will probably be, well, there will only be if the regulation demands it, mm-hmm. FICA process, but we will certainly have enough information that would qualify as FICA, which would be ID number, etc.
Right, okay. Yeah. Justin, you were saying that this, this has the opportunity to go, you spoke about potentially hundreds of millions of customers, mm-hmm. which would put it outside South Africa if you're going to get that
Absolutely,
sort of number.
Yeah.
What is your... what are your growth plans in that regard? Are you going to focus specifically on South Africa now during this early during these early stages as a test market, or are you going to go global initially? Can you actually stop it from not going global initially?
We can't really, no. You know, if somebody wants to enlist and enroll, and we already have some, I was looking through the database this morning, really do have some foreigners who've enrolled. And if a vendor in, you know, Ghana wants to accept them, well, we're not going to stop them. But for the test period, yes, I mean, it makes a great deal of sense for us because we've got a, you know, again, the supply-demand scenario, which we haven't really spoken about, but we've got to try and match it as closely as possible. So in the citizen enrollment process, we are asking people for their location. What town or city do they live in? And if they live in a city, what suburb do they live in? And it's the purpose of that is to as close as possible match that to a vendor in a particular area.
Okay.
So we can go to vendor A and say, Mr. So-and-so, you've got a, well, for argument's sake, a coffee shop, one off, in this area. We have 5,000 people on our database who have X number of Ubus in their wallets. We can send them to you, and the wallet functionality is there's a big marketing component to this as well. There's real estate on the wallet, so you can push your products directly to those customers. We can to some extent we can geolocate that, although that's a level of sophistication that we don't have in the app as yet, but it will come in due course because it's necessary. And then, so in a sense, matching supply with demand, because what you don't want is customers or citizens out there. We call them citizens there because they're not beneficiaries. Mm. So we've chosen something a little more neutral than that. Who you know, with thousands and thousands of these units in their wallet that they haven't been able to use for months on end. Well, what happens? People get bored of them, like you do with your Voyager miles, because you can't use them. And you can't upgrade, and you can't find a hotel that'll take them, et cetera, so the system gets abandoned. So we're trying to scale it out at that level, trying to match it as closely as possible. It remains to be seen how successful we are.
Just a thought: you're going to need a phone to access this e-wallet.
Yes.
Does that mean you have to have a smartphone? And if you do, what does that imply for the market that you're targeting here? We often don't have smartphones.
So you know, I'm sure you know better as well as we do what the figures are. There's probably about 550 million smartphones, or there will be by the end of 2017. South Africa growth is slowed on the one side, but on the other side, you may have seen in the papers in the last week or so, the $20 smartphone. It has to have a smartphone for a whole bunch of reasons, the interface being the most important. You can't do this via a feature phone because people will have finger trouble. So we're looking at an addressable market of about 500 million people by the end of 2017.
Worldwide?
No, so Africa.
In Africa.
Okay. Sorry, 500 million phones in Africa. Mm. And we believe that the slowing growth curve of smartphone adoption will be completely reversed by the $20 smartphone that's due to arrive any day now.
Right. Okay. So a couple of years out, probably just about everyone will have a smartphone.
Yes. Yeah, but we have. I mean, we're not addressing that end of the market either. Mm-hmm. We do have. We have got plans, and we know how to do it technologically, in instances and communities, for instance, where there's very low smartphone penetration. We have a capturing device at the point of sale.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's really is. It's,
okay.
And then the wallet sits, the individual wallets sit there. They're only able to be activated by the end user themselves. All the security protocols would be in place. So it's not that we're not able to get there.
Mm.
But the other point, which is a very important point, coming back to the economics of this, is that if we focus this in the bottom at the bottom of the pyramid only, it would be a system that would probably be trapped there, would never generate a great deal of value, would probably never get off the ground. The adoption of a unit like this, the use of reward programs, loyalty programs, et cetera, is dramatically higher in the middle and upper middle classes. Mm. And there will be value in there for everybody. And that's where you attract. In other words, to get to the bottom, you've got to start in the middle, or not necessarily at the top, but you've got to start where there's disposable income.
Mm.
Yeah, if I could just add something that Justin alluded to, is one of the initial applications that drove this entire process. By the way, we're funded out of Norway, mm-hmm. and our Norwegian's partners, Norway's the biggest donor in the world, a donor. And one of the initial potential applications of the donor's donation aid, about somewhere between 60 and 70%, I think is the figures, gets stolen, lost, or broken, or disappears on the way to the recipient.
Wow.
And there was a question, could we use this as a way so to sort of close some of the holes that stuff is dripping out of? And the answer is absolutely yes. But there are two issues that arise there. Donor aid usually goes to people without cell phones, if you think of, you know, refugees in Sudan, and also often goes to people without ID numbers. And with that in mind, we designed a version of the system in which your authentication is voice and not ID number. So your voice is patterned on a capturing device, and only you can take the aid. And secondly, where you don't have the phone, so you go to the distribution center where you have registered and you get your bag of maize. Hmm. So there are different ways to skin the technological cat for different audiences.
Hmm. I should have asked this up front. Is Project Ubu a for-profit entity? And if it is, what's your business model?
Yes, it is a for-profit model. We intend to take the operating entity, which is a company called Ubu Core, and once we have sufficient traction and the unit is stable, and decentralizing that into a DAO. A decentralized autonomous organization. In other words, to release it to the community to manage.
Okay.
All right. So, but we have to. We've got investors to who are looking for a return. It is not an ideology or an ideologically driven model. It's very much a commercial model.
Mm-hmm.
The business model is the issuance of, with every issuance to a citizen, is a dual issuance to several parties. So for every 100 Ubus, there's 11 issued to other parties. Five of those go into what we call the Ubu sphere, and that those will be used and distributed across particularly the early adopters on the vendor or stroke merchant side. And we're looking there at 10 verticals, the 10 largest verticals in the economy. So grocery retail, for argument's sake, telco be another category or another segment. And the early adopters in that will get a share of those for a sustained period of time, just for being the first to market, because we've got to give an incentive for them to get to market. The other five is now split three ways. Two go to the investor group who are looking to recoup their costs for their risk, which is a very high-risk model. Three then go to Ubu Core itself for the operating to fund the operations, and then one into transaction fees, because we are, you know, every blockchain carries with it a cost of some shape or form.
Yeah,
it's really, really difficult to determine what that's going to be 6 months out, but we've got the ability to cover it within that. We think we're well covered between that and the other five that get distributed between the Ubu Core and the investors.
Did I see in the release that you're building this through Amazon Web Services?
Amazon Web Services are currently a hosting partner.
Hosting partner,
but that's just in the initial stages. They happen to be the biggest and the best and the cheapest.
Sure.
Whether we end up on Amazon, it's meant to be portable. We can port it to any other cloud we want. We can port it into a private cloud, etc. I just wanted to add again to something that Justin said. Ultimately, the commercial value of this entire project is when the currency starts to increase in value, everybody wins.
Okay. I see some interesting names behind Project Uber. I saw Doug Reed, ex-Vox Telecom CEO, is involved. Steve, you're a former CTO at Anglo-American and at Altec. Yeah. Justin, you're an ex-advertising industry exec. And I see other names on your advisory board that many people will be familiar with, like former journalist Simon Dingle and former WillTrue CEO Colin Hall. How did all these guys come together?
That's the network effect. Dudley's been talking to a lot of people about this for around about 18 months.
Okay.
Dudley and I go back to university days together. So I was one of the early batch that he approached. Colin is involved through Bridge Capital, and Bridge Capital are shareholders in Project Ubu, and Dudley is a director of Bridge Capital as well. So. He is, at the moment, he's playing a dual role. He's still active and an active director of Bridge, but Project Ubu is taking more and more and more of his time. So the people like Colin, Colin is a doyen of the retail game.
Yep.
Well, he came out of SA Breweries originally, but I mean, there's probably no one else in South Africa with that amount of retail experience.
And he's also got a lot of experience in e-commerce. I remember when he was the CEO of WillTrue, they were doing a lot of innovative stuff back in the late 90s in the e-commerce space.
Yeah. He's an invaluable member of the advisory board to us. Who else did you mention? Simon Dingle?
Yep.
Well, Simon's probably... outside Vinnie Lingham, who lives in New York now, probably South Africa's foremost crypto specialist.
Mm.
He knows the game. He's built exchanges and wallets and all sorts of things for various entities, including the Luno wallet, which is an Aspers entity. And he's also been he knows more about it, and he's played in it for longer than he knows just about everybody globally in the cryptocurrency space. And it's a very small space, growing rapidly, but it's a very small bunch of people. The big names in the game, if you take Twitter followers as a signal, you know, there may be 50 or 60 or 70,000 followers. They're not in the millions, you know, because very few people understand the space still. It's very much nascent.
Yeah.
But Doug is ex Vox Telecom. He's also from the network. He's looking after the commercial side. He's an executive director and manager in the business.
And our chairman, Millard Arnold, who was the first ambassador under Clinton in South Africa, was called trade representative at the time, but he was the first ambassador.
Wow, it's a really diverse crew you've got here. And Steve, you're former CTO. When did you leave Altec?
I left Altec in 2009. I was there from 2004 to 2009. Prior to that, I was CTO at Anglo-American. And before that, I was in the payment game. I was a founder of a company called Prism, which went public on the great and short-lived optimism of the 2000s. And I've been involved in technologies ever since.
Yeah. I was going to ask, what have you been up to for the last 7
writing,
8 years?
Writing novels and starting companies.
And listening to lots of podcasts, I believe. So, guys, just tell me what the plan is now to bring this to market. What are the timelines we're looking at? When can citizens, I use the term in inverted commas, actually download the app and put it on their phones and start earning Ubus, if that's the right term? I know you've got 2 phases to the launch. Take me through those.
Okay. I'm going to answer the first part, and then I'm going to ask Steve to talk about the phases, because that's technologically driven. Well, it's not technologically driven, but the tech behind that is what really determines it. So the app is still in alpha, I suppose would be the correct terminology.
Yeah.
We're playing around with it at the moment, and we've got a deadline in a couple of weeks to have the thing complete, and then we start testing it.
Which platforms is it going to run on?
It'll run on iOS and Android.
Okay.
Yeah. and then with citizens, the part that I did want to answer, we are, in order to match the demand supply thing, which I talked about earlier, is we are encouraging people to pre-enroll and I say pre-enroll because it's a their accounts will be activated, but their wallets won't be active.
Mm-hmm. How do they do that? Do they go to your website?
So they can do that via the website. At the moment, it's a manual process. They send us an email with their details. We're capturing it. From next week, all those forms will be, all that data fields will be online. It'll be mm-hmm. captured.
Okay.
They can enter it self-submit. There is a little bit of information that we require. So we're probably going to track the early adopters types anyway, in any event, which is fine because we need people. Ideally, we want people who have got a certain degree of familiarity and people who have smartphones, obviously.
Mm.
That doesn't help us if somebody doesn't have a smartphone and they enroll. And for that, we will, while their wallets aren't active, from the day that they register or the day following their registration or pre-enrollment, shall I say, they will earn 100 Ubers a day until such time as their wallet is active. And when we release it and they download it, they then log in, activate themselves, and they'll have accumulated 100 times X number of days from sign-up, from early sign-up.
And we don't know at this stage how much those Ubers will be worth.
Well, let's assume that they're worth nil.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Until they can walk into somewhere and exchange them for something.
And then a value will be determined.
And a value will be determined in that particular environment. Mm. The next environment might be different.
Mm.
There's going to be a great deal of volatility in it, which in itself is going to be... You know, there's a huge amount of education in this whole process. We're staying away from education on cryptocurrency and blockchain stuff, except for the tech space, because the consumer doesn't know, and they don't need to know. It's not important to them.
It'll just confuse them.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because you try and explain. Well, Steve does a good job of it, actually, explaining blockchain. But you try and explain, you know, mining, crypto mining, to a layman, and it's a difficult concept. So, Steve, do you want to talk to the phases?
Yeah, so the phases is we come out of alpha test at the end of September, and then the application will be publicly available to a select group of people in sort of a beta test mode where we start to scale up slowly. And beta test sort of diffuses naturally into public availability. So what we're doing is we're controlling the rollout as a beta test so that we don't scale up too fast. We will run with that for as long as it takes. And what I mean with that is we need not only the interface to be usable and with no snags, not only does it have to be put through security testing and security beating, but we also have to test that the maths underlying the economic system keeps the monetary system stable. We may have to change parameters if we see inflation running away or if the value is depreciating too fast. It's our guess that we will move onto a public blockchain somewhere around the end of the first quarter next year, and then we're done. So those are the two phases, September 1st and probably towards the end of the first quarter next year, but I don't want to be tied down to that either because it depends on the uptake and various other technical and user issues that come up along the way. There is a gold rush right now, as you know. There is at least one ICO a day. That's initial coin offering a day. That's the Wild West. There are people with real intent. There are scammers. There's the whole thing. This is the internet 1995. And we're in no rush to drop into the middle of this maelstrom until we are certain that this product is hardened.
I was going to ask, do initial coin offerings have any applicability to what you're doing here?
They may have.
They may have. Can we say that there are discussions and plans around various unique and differentiated versions of that which we can't talk about right now?
Okay. So, Steve, are you doing all the development for this in-house, or do you have a partner involved?
No, I do it all in my basement by myself. Yeah, we didn't want to obviously have a large staff. We're a startup with seed funding, as I said, from Norway, and part of that seed funding was set aside for us to find the correct team to do the development of this. We went out on a bid and we landed on a company by the name of Sovtech, S-O-V-T-E-C-H, in Craighall Park. Who have some experience in and around this. There are very few experiences who have the blockchain, who have a great deal of blockchain experience, but they brought on one or two blockchain experts and they've done a fabulous job for us, and we will probably stay aligned with them as a partner. That being said, we'll be bringing in more sophisticated technical staff into the company as we begin to grow, like chief architects and product managers and the like.
Mm. Great. So, Steve, if people want to find out more about this, where should they go to?
Okay, it is www.projectubu.co.za.
And Ubu is spelled U-B-U.
U-B-U.
Which is serendipitously and luckily a mixture of universal basic income and Ubuntu.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Steve Sidley is Technology Director and Justin McCarthy is Project and Marketing Director at Project Ubu. Thank you for speaking to us on the Tech Central podcast today and all the best with the endeavor.
Thank you and thanks for having us.
Thanks, Duncan.